Democracy is on the ticket this November, and getting politically engaged has never been more important, even if it's only a hashtag activism. Check out Future Hindsight, a weekly civic engagement podcast, for a conversation with Alice Marwick on the role of social media and online communities to build political power. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, October 12th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, historian, author, Christopher Shaw. On money, power, and the people, the American struggle to make banking democratic. Meanwhile, Amy Coney Barrett hearings begin with multiple COVID and would-be COVID carriers in the room. And the COVID in chief gets a green light, well, actually a greenish-yellowish, sort of an avocado light, to hit the campaign trail in Florida. Speaking of Florida, Florida explodes with new COVID cases as 13 states hit record highs. Senate Republicans are trying to sabotage an economic stimulus deal. California Republicans set up fake drop boxes, presumably to ballot harvest. Federal court temporarily reverses the expanded Ohio drop box program, and another in Pennsylvania tosses Trump's mail-in voting lawsuit. Anthony Fauci rips the Trump ad that twists his words. And one dead after a Pinkerton security guard shoots during a Denver protest. Lastly, as the Republican Senate and House picture darkens, Republican Senator Dan Sullivan is caught in a lobbying scandal involving Pebble Mine. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today. It is it's a pleasure to have you. We are now, I believe it is 21 days. Is it 21 days, Brendan, that we're out from the election?
By my math, my arithmetic, my abacus, 21 days.
All right. I mean, that's a lot of qualifiers there. I imagine you're using the same one as everyone else. If it's not 21 days, it's 22 days. I mean, it could actually end up, I mean, let's be clear here. It is very likely, well, I don't know if it's very likely. It is likely that we will not know who the winner of the election is on election, so-called election day, that is November 3rd. This year. But that is presumably when all voting has to end, and the counting either begins or continues, depending on which batch of ballots you're talking about in which state. Now, it's conceivable that Joe Biden has such an overwhelming victory in unexpected states, or states that I should say, Hillary Clinton did not win in 2016. Let's say your Floridas or your Ohio's, maybe your Arizona's, that we will get a call on the 3rd, but that is unlikely. I have seen no one anywhere predict that Donald Trump will get more votes in this election than Joe Biden. Has anyone, Matt, Brendan, have you guys seen anybody predict that at all? Even in like the fever swamp era? Well, I suppose there's some in the fever swamps.
Maybe Trump himself at one point said, if I wanted to, I could beat him in the vote.
That's right. Okay. Yes. But of course, why would you want to if you're running for president? Why would you want to? It's conceivable that Joe Biden could get so many votes that it could end the question on November 3rd. And when we wake up on November 4th, Donald Trump is a lame duck president. I would imagine he will, there will be lawsuits if that is the case. And I imagine there'll be lawsuits, even if it is a question that the election's not resolved at that point. I imagine that the November 4th is going to be a good day if you are an attorney working with the federal courts involving election. So we will see about that. But like I say, we are now 21 days out and counting. And today, of course, the Amy Coney Barrett hearings began. There was no questioning. It was all just the 22, I believe it was, senators giving opening statements, some via Zoom because they are afraid of, or I should say concerned, or, you know, I think being responsible is really the question of being in the same room with people who were diagnosed as getting COVID in the Trump super spreader event and others who have refused to get tested. Now, I don't know if they have refused to get tested and actually not gotten tested, or they just are refusing to concede that they've been tested. We don't know. But I wouldn't go in that room were I a senator, but I also wouldn't go in that room because the hearing should not be happening now. And we had Democratic senators who got up there. I saw some of the opening comments. They ranged from fair to poor, frankly. I didn't see all of them. It's conceivable there have been some that have been good, but it is very difficult to try and project to the American public that these hearings are a sham if you attend them. That's just a very difficult trick to do. And so, I heard Amy Klobuchar say, call for people who are watching the opening hearings to, contact their Republican senators and put pressure on them and tell them that it is inappropriate what they're doing. But I'm sorry, that's not going to work. There's not a mass amount of Americans who are tuning in to hear the opening statements. If you want to signal to the American public that something is a sham, then you don't participate in it. You have a press conference or you have some type of rally out in front of the Senate building, socially distanced rally, where you say, we're not going to go into that building because what they're doing is a sham. You need to show, not just tell. I'm not going to come on this program and say, this program is completely illegitimate. I do not want you to watch. It just doesn't make sense. And so, I don't know if this is just a failure of politicking or on some level, if it is a way of the Republicans, the Democrats trying to have their cake and eating it too, insofar as they don't want there to be too much pressure on them to expand the size of the court. I mean, that's what this is very much, I think, for a lot of Democratic senators. They don't want the pressure on them to expand the court if Joe Biden wins. They don't want it. Makes sense for Joe Biden not to say anything right now because he doesn't want to alienate his base any more than he already has. A vote for Joe Biden is simply a vote for against Donald Trump for a lot of Democrats. And non-affiliated voters, frankly. And so he doesn't want to alienate those people. But at the same time, there's every reason to believe, based upon his history, based upon the people that support him, Chris Coons, that they do not have an intention to expand the size of the court, which is a, you know, I mean, and we'll have that argument in the coming months and weeks, probably, as to why I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. And it's a necessary thing to do. But they don't want that political pressure. And so they don't want this fight with Amy Coney Barrett to, they're trying to thread the needle here. They want it to activate people who are concerned about the ACA and concerned about a woman's right to have sovereignty over her own body, as well they should. But they don't want to activate people too much so that they are beholden to actually taking material, legitimate steps in the future to prevent these things from happening. We'll talk more about this. We'll talk more about this as the in the coming weeks. In the meantime, couple of ads for us today. And I should remind you that, you know, if I'm up here doing a personal endorsement for a product, it's because we use it. And in some instances, we have one today. It's something that I used before we got ads for them. Because I was like, I'm using it already. I like it. Let's advertise for it. One of those sponsors is ZipRecruiter. We have someone on our staff who I found through ZipRecruiter, or in many respects, ZipRecruiter found for us. You can make your hiring easy like I did by visiting ZipRecruiter.com/majority. What happens is ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites. They don't stop there. They have powerful matching technology. ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes, and they find people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. That's what happened to Brendan. Now, I got a ton of great candidates. I interviewed, I don't know, probably a dozen people. I could have interviewed like three dozen. And ZipRecruiter made it all very reasonable and manageable for me. They have an online sort of like a dashboard, so you can rate them internally for yourself. So you know, like, this is someone I want to interview. This is someone I might want to interview. This is someone I think probably I'll just file away maybe in the future. ZipRecruiter makes the entire hiring process completely efficient and completely effective. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Now, I have told you, I've said this many times before, the best time to find great candidates for your job is when you don't need them. Because a lot of times you have a small business, somebody says, I'm leaving in 2 weeks. You're like, wait, what? I need more time to find somebody. So go around, play with ZipRecruiter right now, get a sense of exactly what it would take to find your quality candidate within the first day. Or, I don't know, for me, I found the process actually to be easy enough that I kept it going for a couple of days. Right now, try ZipRecruiter for free. My listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. Meanwhile, as you know, online shopping has taken off these days. Maybe there's some like major mega sites you want to avoid, but you also want to get the best prices. That used to mean for me, in fact, I have told the story many times, I would sit my daughter down. I'm like, look, if you're going to buy this stuff, there's coupon codes out there. You search the coupon codes. And then the coupon code thing got really complicated and difficult. You'd have to try out 5 different ones. Well, now there's a solution for that. It's Honey. It's the free browser extension. It scours the internet for promo codes, automatically applies the best one available at checkout. It's basically your online shopping best friend. Here's how it works. You get Honey on your computer. You get it for free. 2 easy clicks. And by going to joinhoney.com/majority. joinhoney.com/majority. Then when you're checking out one of its over 30,000 supported sites, Honey pops up and all you have to do is click apply coupons. Then Honey searches for coupons for that site. If Honey finds working codes, it'll apply the best one to your cart. Honey has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. I've been using this a lot lately because, like many parents, I feel a little guilty about my kid being a shut-in for most of the time. Or at the very least, he's not super psyched to go out and play when he's got to wear his mask. So we've been hitting a lot of the Legos hard. And you find them at all different type of places because he likes very specific ones. Well, I don't have to worry about trying to apply a coupon code to random places that sell different building supplies and tinker sets. And you know, I save $5 here. I save $10 here. All of a sudden, I got another set for him. That's at least his attitude towards it. It's simple. If you have a computer, Honey should be on it. It's free and it works with whatever browser you use. You can get Honey for free today at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney, honey like the thing that bees make, .com/majority. And lastly, this is a sponsor who I was using for, I don't know, a couple of years. And then we got them to become a sponsor. What is the perfect time to plant trees and shrubs? Well, if you go to a big box store to buy your plants or trees, they will say, don't know, or good question, or I don't know. It's actually in the fall. This is, I had no idea about this, but right now is the best time to go to fastgrowingtrees.com. All right. I have planted in the past several weeks a royalty crab apple tree. I have planted two toka plum trees. And I planted two bloomerang trees, which are like, they grow to like 6 or 8 feet tall and lilacs and two different blooms. That's where they bloom and they come back. But the point is that I don't know if fast growing trees grow faster, but they're bigger. And so second year, you're getting blossoms, you're getting blooms, and in some instances, you're getting a couple of pieces of fruit. That's unheard of. These trees all showed up. They were at least from anywhere from 5 to 7 feet tall. They ship them to you. It's amazing. And that's why I love fast growing trees. And I also, a couple of years ago, I got some Hoisu Asian pear trees. And we got an Asian pear last year. 1 year out. This year, we're going to get a bunch, or next year, I should say, next spring. So look, skip the big box stores. Head to fastgrowingtrees.com. It's the world's largest online nursery. You don't have to wait in lines. You don't get your car messy. Whether you're looking for shade or privacy or fruit trees, just to add a color for your yard, every plant is shipped with a well-developed root system. It's ready to explode with new growth, I should say, come spring. It's got a 30-day alive and thrive guarantee, means your plants will arrive happy, healthy, and ready for planting. So now through November 15th, got about a month, go to fastgrowingtrees.com/majority for 10% off. That's 10% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/majority, fastgrowingtrees.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Christopher Shaw. His new book is Money, Power, and the People: The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. We'll be right back in just a sec. Okay, on the phone, or I should say on the Zoom, with an amazing backdrop, is historian and author Christopher Shaw, author of Money, Power, and the People: The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. Christopher, welcome to the program. Oh, we're having problems with sound.
Can you hear me?
Christopher, are you there? Yes.
I'm there. Yeah.
Glad to be here. For joining us. I love your backdrop. That's awesome.
You know, it's 2020. It's a tough time. You got to do something fun. So
my not so great attempt.
I think it's great. And I really enjoyed your book. And of course, you know, we've heard so much about the post office. You have written a postal banking book in the past, and I want to get into that. That's something that's been one of my sort of one of my bailiwicks, I think, over the years. But let's start with, I mean, your book basically runs from more or less the beginning of the 20th century through, I guess, almost to present day. I mean, during the Obama administration and certainly the last banking crisis that we had. Let's start with the just broadly speaking, your book is, I guess, a way for us to stop limiting our imagination as to what is possible in terms of power in fighting the power of the big banks.
That's exactly right. I mean, you have these earlier generations of Americans who were prepared and took on Wall Street, and they won a series of important victories. And we shouldn't limit our political imagination or imagine that certain ideas are off the table, that policies are impossible, that we can't have a say in these vital questions around banking and money and finance that totally shape the economic world we live in and also the political world that we are in. So, yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about there are two eras that you're writing about in particular, where there was a big pushback and reforms to the banking industry. And to some extent, they're separate eras. They're contiguous in many respects. I mean, but for the World War II, but we're talking about the Progressive Era and then the era just before the Depression. We have recently talked quite a bit about the Progressive Era, but give us a little bit of background of it and how, you know, where this sort of, I guess, pushback against banking emanated from, because it really did emanate from many different sectors of society.
Right. So the Progressive Era, I mean, it's a response to the First Gilded Age, this time of incredible economic inequality and political corruption. And so it's a time when society is trying to work out all the issues and problems that it's dealing with. And so the Progressive Era is the moment when we are seeing ideas that are sort of a legacy from the Gilded Age come to the front in terms of banking and finance. So you have the populists of the 1890s, their ideas about things like silver, and then ideas they took from people called the greenbackers, the idea that it's possible for the government to just print money and that could actually be money. So this is getting away from the gold standard, the idea that all money has to be gold. So that's one of these strands. You also have a real celebration of the idea of labor, the idea that it's the people who do the work who actually produce the wealth of the nation and are entitled to that wealth. Certainly there's Christian egalitarian ideals that are important at the time as well. And then in the Progressive Era, you begin to have an interest in direct democracy, so things like the initiative, the referendum, and also socialism is a vital force in American politics at this time. So there's this big stew of all these ideas circulating at the time. And they all come together in this push, this idea that bankers need to be more accountable, that bankers should answer to the people, and that people should have a say about how finance operates. And ultimately, you're going to create a financial system that is going to operate more in the interests of working people and less in the interests of Wall Street.
I'm trying to hold off on asking this question in a broad way, but it keeps cropping up as I hear you talking. What was it at that time that made people, because I'm comparing it to like 2008 and to present day, where you have like consumer credit is just a complete ripoff for people. I mean, we were able to establish the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but it was assaulted by the Trump administration. But what made people so sensitive or so conscious of the fact that the banking system, right, which is something that becomes a little bit opaque, I think, for most people, was problematic? Was it just one of the things, or was it, I mean, how broad was this understanding of how banking was problematic?
I mean, there's a number of issues at the time. I mean, in terms of economics, there's antitrust, there's a bunch of things going on. But in terms of why banking and finance was so important is the late 19th century is this period of deflation. So grinding deflation, where essentially the price level keeps falling and falling and falling. And what this means is that if you're a farmer, you're stuck in a situation where you take out a loan to buy the seeds to plant your crop, you know, and then 6 months later, you actually have to pay more money back than you borrowed, you know, and depending on the length of your loan, you have to pay even more money back. And so this led to the rise of the greenbackers and also then the populists, these ideas of financial central as well. And this real problem with the gold standard, because if you're going to base money on gold, you're basing it on one item. And there's only so much of that item in the world and in the United States. And when the economy is growing very rapidly, the monetary system, the amount of money just can't keep up with that. And so because of this deflationary spiral that went on for decades, that really clued in these late 19th century reformers into this issue. And so there's this whole legacy, this inheritance of knowledge about finance and banking that then people have in the early 20th century. And they put to good use at that time, because then this is also the time when the bankers themselves, because there's a big banking panic in 1907.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because that's where you start your, that's the first chapter of your book. We start with that the banking panic of 1907, or I should say the bankers' panic of 1907.
Yeah, so this is, it has to do with basically shenanigans on Wall Street that go awry. And as a result, there's a lot of uncertainty in New York City about the safety of certain banks. And so you start getting bank runs and the whole thing just goes out of control and then it spreads all the way across the nation. And the result is unemployment shoots up and we're in the middle of a pretty harsh depression back at the time when there aren't government programs to look after people in any ways. And so for ordinary citizens, this is another example of how finance is out of control, how finance can come along and really mess things up. And for bankers, this was scary too, because they're thinking, you know, this got out of hand very fast and it wasn't good for the economy at all. And so we're looking at reforms now. And so once the bankers put the idea of reforms on the table, this is where you get a grassroots politics comes in and really picks it up and runs with it and takes it in directions that the bankers had not anticipated and did not want.
So, I mean, just to be clear, you have a pre-existing grassroots movement that is there and fomenting and fermenting, I guess, and simmering in many respects. And then there's this brief window of opportunity that happens, right? I mean, we're talking about the banker's panic was, what, 3 or 4 weeks long. This opened up an opportunity where bankers themselves, people who, you know, I guess literally and figuratively have the keys to the system, and they drop their guard. And because you already have this pre-existing grassroots movement, there's like for a moment almost like a power vacuum. I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of, like, you know, what the circumstances are that pushes through legislation in these moments, and how, you know, the bankers could let this sort of get out of their control in some respect. And so can you walk through that dynamic?
Right. So what happens is the bankers after this, they want something that can come in and stabilize the economy when things start going wrong. And so they start talking about a central bank. And once they start talking about a central bank, then that opens the door to all kinds of changes. And so that's the moment also then when you get these, I think it's kind of hard for us to imagine this now, but these are just ordinary citizens, workers, farmers, people who, you know, work through manual labor for a living. They know about this. They have this inheritance and they know about these issues. And so they then start talking about things like having a savings bank at the post office. They start pushing back against the gold standard. They talk about the idea that the government will lend money to farmers at low rates so that farmers will stop getting price gouged by bankers. And they also have a very different idea of what a potential central bank should look like, because they think that, in fact, this should be government should basically control this bank, and therefore it would be more democratic. You'd have more opportunities for transparency and public input. Whereas the bankers, they just want a central bank that'll basically be, they will own it and they will control it. So you have very different ideas here about what this reform is going to look like. And so there's this clash over the next few years in terms of what actually happens during the Progressive Era.
So what happens in that era in terms of reforms? I mean, we have reforms that come out of early Depression era. What is that first era more marked by simply, ideas getting into the bloodstream that maybe are a little before their time in terms of when they will be adopted, certainly, or overdue, I guess. I mean, how much is adopted at that point and how much is still sitting out there on the table, and how much does the bankers win in something, let's say, like the Fed?
Okay, so like you say, for one thing that happens, it just puts a lot of ideas on the table and gets more discussion about them, and some of them will get picked up down the road. But immediate things we see is that we do get the creation of a savings bank at the post office. So now you can walk into a post office and you can put your money there in a savings account. It's just a basic savings account, but that's one thing. There's an act in 1910 that gets that up and running. And another thing that we get is the beginning of...
I'm sorry, can I just interrupt for 1 second? Because this is really important. And I think people just are amazed by this on some level, because it seems so fantastical when we talk about postal banking in this era. That lasted for 50 some odd years, right?
That's right.
You could get a bank account at the post office for 50 years in the first half of the 20th century.
That's right. Yeah. More than half a century. You could walk into a post office and open a savings account there. Absolutely. Yep.
All right. Well, we'll circle back around to that when we get up into the 1960s, so that we can talk about why that ended and why it shouldn't have. But continue on with the other reforms that came in that era.
Right. So other ones is you get the beginnings of a farm credit system. So this is the government is getting involved in making sure that farmers can now access affordable credit. So this is actually considered to be really a breach of the way that business and government should interact. But this goes through in 1916. And then between these two reforms, you also get a number of states erect bank deposit insurance or deposit guarantee programs, so that if the bank fails, you can get your money back. And these states are mostly in the Great Plains, but this happens in the state level. The big thing on the federal level we all know about is the Federal Reserve system gets enacted in 1913, and it's up and running shortly after that. And in terms of how does it look different because of grassroots political engagement, well, the thing that is really different is that the bankers thought they would essentially set up a central bank. They would probably own it, they thought, and they would definitely exert control over it in terms of the governing board. And what we end up with is a system that is more decentralized than they wanted, but also you have a governing board of the Fed where the members are presidential appointees who are then confirmed by the Senate. So this principle of public authority over the nation's central bank is enshrined in the Federal Reserve Act, and that is not something that the bankers had wanted at all.
Now, with that said, it's not as democratic, I think, as they wanted, and certainly I think on some level as many want today. But it is not as I guess private or I should say distinct from political pressures as they wanted it to be. And we can return to that. So we're in between these two eras of the major banking reform, and I think more comes obviously following the beginning of the Great Depression. But let's take this time to sort of stop and talk about a couple of the figures that were really prominent then. As a kid, I used to go into the Worcester Center Galleria and shop at Filene's basement all the time. I had no idea who Edward Filene was. Tell us about him.
He was a wealthy businessman, you know, as we all know from the stores that still exist, but he was also a very progressive minded, and he's trying to think of ways to make basically the economy operate so that it will treat working people better. And he decides that one way to do this is to bankroll a movement to set up credit unions in the country. So credit unions being banks that are owned by the depositors and controlled by them, and they get to elect the people who run these credit unions. So he's the big force in terms of putting up the money that allows the credit unions to get organized. And, you know, now this is probably the most important example of cooperative enterprise that we have in this country today. And he's the one who really paid for that to happen.
So he gave them basically, you know, the functional equivalent of bridge loans to start up these enterprises. And what was it about him? Like, it's hard to imagine a businessman at this point who is, you know, maybe that's unfair on some level, but it's, I don't know. What was it about his history or the tradition he was coming from that saw that as important?
You know, there's a bunch of these kind of self-made businessmen in the late 19th and early 20th century who, this is a time when there's a lot of conflict between capital and labor, right, between workers and their employers. And they're all kind of searching for ways to ameliorate this, to make these differences less stark and reduce industrial conflict. And he's one of these people. I mean, workers are turning to unions at this time. These employers tend to be looking in for other things, you know, and so this is where filing gets behind the idea of the credit union and starts the organization that goes out and helps workers to organize that. But this was definitely something, yeah, businessmen, major industrial leaders were thinking about at the time.
Well, just to be clear, so he's doing this to let the air out of the tires, as it were, of some social movements.
I think that, look, I don't want to, I'm sure that he had good intentions and things like that. But this is also a time when there are more radical proposals and possibilities out there. And a lot of these businessmen are looking for something that's a little less far reaching.
I guess what I'm trying to tease out is that we have this dynamic of the capitalist class, if you will, seeing that there is enough turmoil that they need to do something to head off certain movements. Maybe they're doing it because they're nice guys, and maybe they're doing it because they have interests, or maybe they're doing it because they think it's better for society, whatever it is. But they are compelled to introduce these reforms, which are in some instance good things, maybe don't go far enough, but more positive than what existed before. And it's in direct relationship to the threats that they see to the status quo as a way of like saying, okay, let's go to status quo 0.20, as it were, or 2.0, as it were, because we're not going to be able to sustain status quo 1.0, and we will end up at status quo 4.0 if we don't basically offer up 2.0. I mean, that's the dynamic that we get when we go into, in many respects, into the Great Depression.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's, you know, for instance, there was a shoe company called Endicott Johnson Shoes. And, you know, they gave all the workers a square deal. Well, if the workers hadn't have had the possibility of, you know, joining a union, if there had been all these other things going on at the time, probably the square deal would not have looked the way that it did. So, yeah, I think you've described that dynamic very well.
Okay, so let's also talk about Wright Patman for a little bit. I've read a little bit about him, but heard things. But give us a sense of who he was and what he represented to, I guess, this broader notion of banking reform.
He was from East Texas. He was grew up in a log cabin from very humble origins, and he was definitely influenced by this populist tradition. And particularly concerns about monopoly. So this idea that there's these vast corporations that have inordinate influence and power over the economy and over politics, and we have to find some way to curb them and bring them to heel. And particularly, he was interested in how this played out in the world of banking and central banking. And so he was very much interested in doing what could be done to curb the power of Wall Street. And he really devoted, you know, he was in Congress for decades, and this is kind of his pet project, his pet issue throughout that time period from the 1930s all the way up until the 1970s, actually.
Also, I mean, while we're here, I guess, let's talk about Huey Long as well in that era before we move into the beginning of the Great Depression and some of it. He started a tell us about Huey Long. He started his own the share of the wealth. So this idea of wealth inequality, it's not what's old is new again, or maybe has never gone away in some respects.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so Huey Long is a politician from Louisiana. I mean, he was gets a lot of power there, creates kind of a political machine. We see authoritarian impulses there, but he did actually have a real political agenda. And the reason he had political support is because he was interested in transforming the lives of poor Louisianans and making them better. So as governor of the state, I mean, he builds roads, he builds hospitals, he makes education more available. He does all of these things. And then when the Depression hits, he says, hey, you know, the main issue here is the wealth is not distributed nearly as broadly as it needs to be. So he starts something called Share Our Wealth Society. And, you know, Share Our Wealth, that sums up the idea. Basically, you're going to have taxation in ways that are going to make it so that ordinary people would have a lot more money and the really wealthy just could not get any richer. And he's also then worried about the role that banks play in this economic inequality of the time. So he gets involved in that in the early years of the Depression.
And he is initially supportive of FDR, but then critical of FDR from the left, feeling that his first set of, I guess, New Deal reforms did not go far enough. Just talk about that dynamic, because many of the things that he was talking about ended up getting instituted. I don't know, many, but some of the key ones got and became instituted later. Just talk about that dynamic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are a number of figures that are to the left of Franklin Roosevelt, and they're constantly pushing him. And Huey Long was probably the most prominent of them because he has a national profile. He basically is the political king of an entire state. And, you know, his main thing is share our wealth. And Roosevelt responds directly to this with a tax that they called it a millionaire's tax that's targeted directly at really the wealthiest people in America. And you also hear in a lot of the rhetoric then that Roosevelt starts to adopt leading up to the 1936 election, that he is identified that the share of wealth, the economic inequality that Huey Long talks about is something that voters are hearing. They're worried about it. And he begins to adopt some of this language and also some of these policies.
And so let's talk about what we see following, I mean, in those policies. I mean, specifically with some of the, we get FDIC, we get Glass-Steagall. FDIC is, we have this idea that exists in the states. I guess, I don't know if they called them SDIC, but they were basically states, deposit insurance corporations, as it were. Right. And then this gets federalized to protect small depositors, relatively small depositors, I guess, money in these banks and to prevent bank runs, et cetera, et cetera. What else comes out of this? And then let's talk about how what happened from this moment where you have these banking reforms and this sort of like greater awareness of the power of banks, then it's really just sort of like a slow degradation, really, until you get to the 90s when, you know, all shackles are off, essentially, and there seems to be a loss of generational memory of the problem that can happen when banks have too much power and too much over basically our lives, our economy.
Yeah, the FDIC is probably one of the most underrated reforms that we have, because prior to the establishment of the FDIC in 1934, if you are someone who has a savings account or a checking account, you're constantly worried that the bank might fail and you might lose, if not all of your savings, then a good portion of them. And so this injects a lot of instability into the system, because anytime that the economy starts to have problems, or that you begin to have questions about the safety of a particular bank, you could have a bank run. And this could quickly escalate to the situation where you have a full-blown banking panic. And this can create a depression, or it can make a depression worse. And so the FDIC really goes very far to stabilizing the economy. And so you'd have like regular depressions that banks either caused or magnified like every 10, 20 years, ever since the 19th century. And this stops after the FDIC. And this was something, a reform that actually bankers at the time said would really be the end. I mean, this was going to have terrible consequences, and it ends up being entirely the opposite from what they thought. And so the people pushing for this, I mean, it wasn't academics, it wasn't anybody like that. It was workers and farmers. It was grassroots people who were worried about losing their money, and also thought that this would be a way to stabilize the banking system, and they were right.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to point out here, because I cannot tell you the amount of conversations I've had over the past 10 years. Well, it's not that many. I don't know that many bankers, but it's enough where I've talked to people in finance and whatnot, and they say, look, government regulators, they don't understand. They don't understand this stuff. It's too Byzantine for them. They don't understand. They're cloistered. They don't get it. And that's their excuse as to why there shouldn't be any reforms imposed upon them. What did the bankers at that time, what did they fear about the FDIC? What obligations did the FDIC put on them, as opposed to it just being a just straight out like the government's going to backstop you in some way?
Yeah. So what they claimed is, you know, this economic concept of moral hazard, the idea that basically they said, hey, you know, bankers are really going to take advantage of this. They're going to do all kinds of corrupt practices if they know that they can get away with it, because the government is going to come in and backstop. And that's what their objection was. They also had this kind of ideological objection that, like, you know, you need to research a bank before you put your money there. And if the bank isn't good, then you deserve to lose your money if it fails. I mean, this sort of laissez-faire.
This is a very libertarian concept that we hear from libertarians, where it's like, if you need to bone up on banking practices and audit the bank before you deposit your paycheck in there, as if you have a lot of time and expertise to make those assessments of banks. And that's in between when you go out and get your electrician's, when you become an electrician to know if your housing is okay, is your electrical's right, and your so on. But yes, that is a very libertarian concept. And so they had an ideological problem with it. Did they have any, was there any imposition upon the banks in this instance from the FDIC?
Well, yeah. So what they, you know, the other thing that they didn't talk about as much is the fact that there was additional regulations. Basically, the government now is, the federal bank examiners are taking a lot closer look at the books and are watching them a lot more closely. And then also they have to pay a certain amount of their deposits into this insurance fund as well. And they constantly, you know, once it's in place and they want to reduce it, they want to pay less money into it. It did interfere with their businesses, and they definitely didn't like that aspect of it. But they did tend to come back to this libertarian idea that we should all, you know, be experts on banking, like you said, before we put any money anywhere. And if we aren't, you know, then we deserve to pay the price for that. And that's kind of a moral obligation almost that we should pay the price for that failure on our parts to not have checked this out thoroughly before we decided to put our money in the bank.
How much of that was like, and because ultimately the FDIC, right, it makes you feel more comfortable about depositing your money in the bank, and then it allows the bank to lend more money out. I mean, it's almost like, I don't want to push the analogy too much, but it was like, you can't force us to have higher CAFE standards for our cars. And then we end up innovating better cars, and they figure out they can do it, and it helps in terms of their sales, or light bulbs for that matter. You can't force us to make more efficient light bulbs, and then they do. And within a couple of years, the light bulb industry is fine and more robust in many respects. And that's what happened with the banking. I mean, obviously they don't want, huge cyclical, I guess what they call non-secular, cyclical depressions and recessions and whatnot. and or enhanced, recessions. So, I mean, how much of it was they also don't want to set a precedent that government can actually go and that the economy is not and like an animal that exists in the wilderness and functions, by itself, that the economy is actually constructed, that we make that there is no such thing as the economy in and of itself. It is always a political economy. It is always a construct of a society in some way. And this sort of is like a little bit of a clue to people that, hey, government constructs this, and it's just a question of how they're going to do it. I mean, how much of it was that?
You know, I think that out of the various kind of, businesses aren't always like American businesses isn't always in agreement about policy and politics. But I think out of all the different sort of divisions within business in the early 20th century, it was the bankers, the people in finance who were the most laissez-faire, who were the most kind of insistent in the idea that if government gets involved in the economy, there will be bad results. And this is just the wrong thing to do. So there's definitely this ideological element where these bankers do not want to have government involved in there. And what they would say is like, hey, the economy has been growing really strongly for, a long time here. And it's because you've let us alone and let us do what we do. This would be their claim. And they believe this very, very deeply.
And they held on to these beliefs till we get, we lose postal banking. And I presumably because the banks don't want the competition ultimately, and they want that business. They know they can get those deposits and they can get those fees that are associated with it, et cetera, et cetera. This grows. And then we get into the 90s and we lose Glass-Steagall, where it just opens up more avenues for banks, commercial banks, to mix with investment banks, and they get more money so that they can leverage more money, presumably. And then we get something like 2008. There was like the delayed kidney punch. You pull back the regulation in the mid 90s, and then the real damage happens 12 years later or so. We just have a couple of minutes left here. Do we have anything in terms of broad-based grassroots movements or any political leaders that you see that are analogous, and where do they from this era, and where do they rate relative? Because I'm just convinced that despite we had that 2008 financial crisis, there's just not the broad-based awareness that existed in the late 19th century, early 20th century, because you had so many people who were farmers who were dealing with banks like this. Like, I think like the experience of small business coming out of the PPP may, sort of like get people to understand like, wait a second, if I was a bigger client, I would have gotten this money, or it would have been easier, or whatever it is. But there doesn't seem to be the broad-based understanding of the role that banks play. And there doesn't seem to be a politician. Elizabeth Warren, I think, is focused on these issues a little bit, but there doesn't seem to be a politician who is capturing the imagination of people around this issue as much as in that era.
I think you're right. I mean, but I would add to that, I started researching this book back in 2006, right? So this is before 2008. And the learning curve has been pretty impressive that I've seen, ever since 2008. I mean, people are learning very fast. And it's true, you don't have like a Wright Patman type figure who has this inheritance to draw on and is engaged in this for decades here. But you do, like you said, have someone like an Elizabeth Warren who's informed on this, Bernie Sanders talking about these issues. Even the Republican Party in 2016 in their platform said they're against too big to fail banks. Now they have the exact same platform in 2020. So, I mean, it's an idea. These ideas are out there in a way that they weren't in the late 20th century. And I think that is hopeful, but it's true. It's not to the level that it was in the late 19th and early 20th century in terms of just the knowledge of the average citizen and the grassroots engagement. That's not where it was, but it seems we're moving in that direction. And I think it's happened pretty fast, really.
I know this is outside your portfolio, but what I mean, what would it take to get there? Like, I mean, is it just that we have a different dynamic in our politics today, and it's going to have to be a smaller sort of group of activists who are a little bit more surgical, or what? I mean, how do we get a broader based awareness about these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one difference is that back then you just had more sort of civic engagement in like local organizations that then were part of larger national movements. And I just don't think there's as much of that these days. But I do think that the more people are engaged, are talking to each other. I mean, that's where it starts. It starts with discussions, right? I mean, that's how you learn about these issues. That's how you inform yourself. That's how you settle on an idea of what reforms need to happen. And then that's how you go forward from there and decide which tactics you're going to use to try to implement these reforms, to try to actually realize them and make them a reality. And I think that, you know, these discussions are happening. People are learning about these issues. This stuff is underway. But, you know, we'll just see how it plays out. And sometimes it's happening faster during moments of crisis. But even when that's not going on, I think that there's sort of these deeper discussions that are happening where people are going to be more prepared the next time that these kinds of issues are right at the forefront of our attention as a nation.
Well, Christopher Shaw, the book is Money, Power, and the People, the American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for coming on the program today. It was fascinating stuff.
Thanks for having me. I appreciated the discussion.
All right, folks. We'll be back in just 1 minute with some updates on what's happening with the Amy Coney Barrett hearing and also with Donald Trump's COVID tour. We are back. Donald Trump is back on the mail-in ballots argument. Again, I think at one point it was Plan C for them. I think Plan A was to try and beat Joe Biden by saying that Hunter Biden and Joe Biden were involved in some type of massive scheme with Burisma. That seemed to have fallen apart probably very much a function of impeachment. In fact, I think it shows the power of impeachment had the Democrats been a little bit broader in their approach to this. We would have seen, I think, a very different dynamic than we've seen since then. And of course, Plan B, and I think, you know, Plan F was probably try and win more votes because it was so out of reach, I think, for Donald Trump. But we'll see. But Plan B is to simply say that the vote tallies that we're seeing are fraudulent. And this one's been in the works for a long time. We will talk in the second hour about the Lincoln Project a little bit there in the news. But I want to remind everybody, when Donald Trump was talking about how the results from California were very dubious, which led to his 3 million vote deficit in the popular vote, it was Paul Ryan who was also stoking those flames, who was out there saying it was very suspicious that Florida was bringing in these mail-in ballots. And that was 4 years ago. I mean, so this has been a long-term project. I mean, the Republicans have been doing this for decades, of course, but I just want to make it clear that it's not just Donald Trump, that the Republican Party does this part and parcel. And those Never Trumpers, they were doing that 4 or 5 years ago as well. So, but here's Donald Trump Saturday at the White House. He spoke for less time than was anticipated. And he did it from his balcony. This, of course, is not a campaign event because that would be illegal. But here he is, just talking about generally mail-in ballots.
I think so. And you're going to see that. And you see how many crooked ballots are being found and turned back in and fraudulent? Just what I said. Then they'll say, he doesn't believe in freedom. I totally believe in freedom. That's called freedom. What we're doing is freedom. Tremendous problems with the ballots. 50,000 in Ohio, 25,000. You have to see it. I mean, every day there's a story about ballots. Some thrown out. They happen to have the name Trump. Military ballots were thrown out with the name Trump on them. Okay? But I think we're going to swamp them by so much. Hopefully it's not going to matter. And we have law enforcement watching. We have law enforcement watching all those ballots. They're being found for a reason. Left-wing politicians like Kamala Harris, who really did not do very well the other night. By the way, did our vice president do a good job, Candace? That was...
He is addressing Candace Owens there. She is the head of the Blexit movement, and where black people are to not vote for Joe Biden, but rather to vote for Donald Trump, I guess. What's interesting about what he says there, he just throws out these numbers, 50,000 in Ohio, and then pivots immediately to the ballots that were found with Trump's name on it. And what he was referring to there were the six ballots that were found out of nine in a Pennsylvania office. Not 6,000, six ballots. So he just seamlessly pivots, like they found 50,000. Did you hear a bunch of those were Trump ballots? No. That it's not the same ballots that he's talking about. And, you know, he is, I don't know what the threat is there, implicit in the idea that there's police officers or law enforcement watching, but that's what we have. So there's Donald Trump's plan B. He is out there hoping that that he can convince his supporters that the... And I should say that those 50,000 ballots, just being reminded here, were all in Franklin County, which is a large blue county. And these were absentee ballots that were put out with wrong names or whatnot. And theoretically, there have to be more ballots sent to them. And hopefully that can be made up. But we will see. These aren't actually ballots that have been filled out. But we will talk more about this. We are 21 days away from the election. We will talk about the Amy Coney Barrett hearings the next hour. And, of course, we will be talking about those hearings tomorrow as they get underway with questioning from members of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. So we will say adieu until tomorrow for those of you who are listening to the first hour of this program. For those of you who are not, who are sticking around, join us in the so-called fun half. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. A lot of people are talking about it. We have, you can get 6-7 minutes of headlines every morning. We're getting it out earlier and earlier, so you can be on top of what the day will bring in terms of news. AMQuickie.com or wherever your podcasts are served. And don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off your coffee. Nomi's show is not happening today. It started, she goes Tuesday through Friday at 3 p.m., but you can check out the Nomi Key show on YouTube and see what she had last week if you missed any of those programs. Also, don't forget the Antifada. You can find that over at patreon.com/theantifada. Matt,
I'll bring Jamie in here.
Oh, is she here? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in the meantime, why don't you tell us what's happening on TMBS, Matt?
I am not actually sure what we have for TMBS, but yesterday for patrons, Napoleon the Legend and Leisha Brooks sat down for an hour-long conversation, so people should check that out. That's up on YouTube for patrons now, and it'll be up for as audio for patrons later.
Oh, shit.
Jamie?
Can you hear me?
Working. Yes, your sound is working, yes.
Does it sound like it's coming through my microphone or through my
It does not at all.
God damn it. All right. I'm going to have to like restart some stuff during the
You break, sound good enough for the plugs, though.
Yeah, go ahead. All right. Yeah, right.
All right, I'll do it. This week on the Antifada, Sean and I will be going over some news, and then we will be expounding on the very topical topic of left communism. Lenin called it an infantile disorder. We call it kind of interesting and cool, maybe outdated as a political tendency. What even is it? We're going to go over all of that. And if you have any questions or critiques about left-wing communism that you would like to send us beforehand, you can do so right up until tomorrow, because that's when we're recording. So patreon.com/theantifada. You can email us at antifadamindset@gmail.com, or, you know, just DM me like people are want to do. Also, our episode from last week is still good. I don't even remember what it's about. Patreon.com/theantifada, folks. You'll love it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Sent us this.
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck your mind.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. Africans. The alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on.
Really? Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.